Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
HHS is now working to invest additional resources to further these efforts.
HHS Secretary Becerra on HPAI.
We've identified $93 million to be used by CDC to expand our monitoring of people exposed to infected animals, to scale up our testing and analysis capabilities, to determine whether candidate vaccines are effective, and to manufacture, store, and distribute additional influenza diagnostic kits. We're investing another $8 million to be used by the FDA to support the agency's ability to conduct surveillance at different points in the milk production system so that we can bolster laboratory capacity as well, and also to provide needed resources to train staff on biosecurity procedures. Additionally, these funds will be used in partnership with states to ensure the milk testing process is working as needed.
This is Agriculture Today.
This far southern state in Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul, they've received over 10 inches of rain across the board in the past couple of weeks.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist with Allendale, talking about weather concerns in Brazil.
Most areas actually quite a bit heavier than that, especially near the population centers. They have death loss numbers and displaced people, which are just outrageous. For our discussion on these grains, you're probably looking at a small amount of first crop corn still out there left to harvest. We estimate about 600,000 tons. That's not a market mover. Maybe for soybeans, where you can argue maybe 4 million tons still outstanding, that's where you can certainly argue maybe a little more of a discussion as far as a moderate price impact here.
Anytime we talk Brazil, we also think soybeans. So what's the global soybean balance sheet look like? We turn to the chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board, Dr. Mark Jekinowski.
Crush up a bit. We raised our crush forecast this month by almost 2 million tons. That's mainly higher crush in China and Brazil, and reduced trade by 600,000 tons. That's mainly lower exports out of Brazil. Focusing on the new crop year, 24-25, big increase in total supply, as you can see, stands out there. Large production increase, large carry-in, so substantial increase in total supply. Crush up as well, higher supplies that's going to be crushed, and also relatively lower supplies of rapeseed and sunseed oil. Rapeseed and sunseed. Another important thing to point out, even though ending stocks here are high, production is high for soybeans, production for rapeseed, sunflower seed is down. So total oilseed production, not necessarily quite as burdensome as this chart might imply. Also anticipating another big increase in China imports, raised that 4 million tons to 109 million. U.S. soybean balance sheet, nothing to talk about on the back year. So new crop year, again, supply driven by prospective plantings and trend yields. Soybean crush expected to be up, reflecting, again, higher supplies and also biofuel feedstock crushing there. Exports up, heavily weighted toward fall. Brazil's exports are lower, Brazil's exports are down, giving us a window in the fall to export soybeans. But with our higher supplies, lower prices, we should pick up some of that business. U.S. Global soybean export share forecast at 28%. Which would be down, 5-year average is about 32% for the U.S. So losing some U.S. global soybean export share there as well. Prices down, those would be the lowest season average prices since 2021. And ending stocks and stocks to use ratio, the highest since about 2019-20 crop year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's the Wyoming King Ranch, originally started by three brothers that immigrated to America and started in the sheep business, and kind of a success story in itself. But great place, had the first flock of Corydell sheep in the United States, and it's been a cattle ranch since 68.
Mark Heisley is the owner of the King Ranch in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's also an award-winning ranch.
Well, that fortunately happened under my watch with lots of contributions from friends and neighbors and family. But we were acknowledged for our management and resource practices, our sustainability, our interaction with agencies, and a whole multitude of good things. And to be even nominated for that is an honor to have won our state one, a big deal. So we were very proud of that.
Ranching in Wyoming, though, a little different than other parts of the country.
Well, it's a labor of love. I love what I do, and I love my colleagues in the business and the industry. But a lot of shows on TV and in the movies have glamorize some of the things that aren't really that important, the drama and some of the personal interactions. But the issues that sometimes they breach, the conflicts with developers, money, land grabbers, those kind of things, agencies, those are all real, very, very much so. And that's the kind of thing, and I'm both a public lands and a private lands rancher, so I experienced some of that up close and personal. In fact, I had bought into the ranch and took over the grazing permit when cattle free by 1993 was the lay of the land or the motto for the activists at that time. So it was quite a steep learning curve.
Now, Isley is the current president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Ethan Lane is vice president of government affairs.
We have 44 state affiliate organizations, all of them with their own policy books, their own boards of directors, their own in-state political dynamics, and some of those states have policy on their state books that seeks fully mandatory traceability for the entire herd. Other states don't want to see anything like that. Some states are voluntary. Some states don't have policy on it. So, you know, like any other issue in the cattle industry, these issues look very different depending on you know, where you are in the supply chain, what phase of production, where you are in the country. And so the job of NCBA is to put together sort of the voices of all those members and all those affiliates around the country and formulate kind of a common policy on this that we can advance at the federal level. And so what we've done over the last 10 or 15 years is have a kind of an evolving policy on this driven by our members that puts forth what we as an industry believe we would like to see in a nationally significant traceability program. Now, that is stays silent on whether we're talking about a government program or an industry-driven solution. But in those tenets, what we say is that our preference is for the industry to be in the driver's seat on the program. Our preference is for the program to not place a financial burden for compliance on our producers. The preference is for that program to move at the speed of commerce, to protect our producers' data, to make sure that it isn't used inappropriately or fall into the wrong hands. So, you know, there's been kind of an evolution over the years of what the industry can agree a successful program might look like, but you're never going to craft something that's going to make everybody happy here. The goal is to be as, you know, inclusive as we can and looking at those different perspectives, and follow our members' lead in where they go with this. And that's a policy they've put forward. So given that, we certainly can support, the tenets of what USDA is doing here. Although it certainly can be noted that I think the preference of our industry is for a producer-led, a voluntary solution.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Demand for sorghum remains really strong when you look at the market from a couple of specific lenses here.
Patrick Wade is with Texas Grain Sorghum.
One of the things, of course, for us as an industry that we are most focused on and have been for the better part of the last decade is the availability and the robustness of the Chinese market for grain sorghum. This has effectively since 2013 or so when we first saw sales really pick up for China. This has dictated not just the flow of sorghum, but a premium in prices, especially here on the export market, and particularly, as we referenced, for those growers on the Texas Gulf Coast and in South Texas who are so proximate to the export locations that we see most of the sorghum in the U.S. go out of. So right now we're looking at, as of the most current numbers we've got from USDA, as of mid-April, we've seen about 200 million bushels total have been contracted to all of our various export markets around the world, and 94% of those have gone to China. Now, we saw last year during the previous 2022-2023 marketing year, due to drought and other challenges, you know, it was a relatively reduced crop that absolutely hit the jet boost when last summer came around and a good South Texas Gulf Coast crop came out. China bought it up right away. It hit the market and was loaded at those ports, whether it's Corpus Christi or Houston or Galveston in Texas, and gone around to China. Look, this remains our most consistent, our most relevant market. And, you know, it's one that's born out of, you know, a couple key factors, I think, that we really take pride in the work that's gone into sort of establishing those. First and foremost, you know, there remains a policy advantage that we have in the Chinese market, in the sense that there is no tariff rate quota for imports of grain sorghum like there is for corn and rice and wheat. So there's no competition within Chinese buyers to say, you know, you get allocated this level of grain that you can buy from the government, otherwise you hit a certain tariff. We're not subject to that in the sorghum market. That remains one of our greatest advantages, as well as the internal demand there. As the Chinese economy, we've seen, has continuing recently to grow leaps and bounds and sort of surpassing some growth targets. You know, pork consumption, baijiu, alcohol that is the most consumed spirit in the world, simply based on the Chinese population numbers, relies heavily on sorghum as one of its seven key ingredients. And we've seen U.S. sorghum sort of enter more into that role as opposed to domestic sorghum. And then, look, lastly, it's about relationships, and whether that's the relationships we've maintained with Chinese buyers and importers and end users there, even through challenging times like COVID or trade war disruptions that have led us to be, you know, remain very close to them, and sort of manifested in the sense that actually a U.S. sorghum trade team earlier this year was the first U.S. ag commodity group to go on a trade mission to China since COVID. And we take pride in that being the sort of result of a lot of good relationship building there.
And just seeing positive basis levels, good prices, is good.
It's good for growers. It keeps sorghum as a relevant crop in their operation. It does also price out some other international buyers, you know, folks like Mexico, for example, who might have been a consistent historic buyer of sorghum, simply aren't going to try to compete with what China bids are coming in at. But it also, in some ways, hinders our ability to, you know, test other markets, simply because the Chinese demand keeps that premium just a little bit above what other countries might want to offer.
This is Agriculture Today.
I know it's a priority for the Secretary of Ag, Secretary Vilsack. I mean, he continues to stress the need of a farm bill to provide for certainty, you know, so that we have our ARC and PLC and crop insurance and acres sign up.
Chandler Gould is CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers.
But, you know, I think the Biden administration missed a huge opportunity to continue to put that pressure on the House and the Senate. The farm bill was not mentioned at all in the State of the Union. We talked, the president talked a lot about climate smart, climate solutions. He even talked about immigration. We talked about transportation and infrastructure. All of those issues, whether it's the Snake River dams or the rail system or the highway system, all of that is not only needed for agriculture production, but I just think a missed opportunity to continue to talk about the largest legislative investment in rural America that the U.S. government does every 5 to 8 years, which is the Farm Bill. And it was completely either overlooked, that's what I'm going to say, but was not mentioned. And we found that to be very disappointing.
And he says even though House and Senate ready to take up their legislation, the clock is ticking.
I've been doing this. This will be my fifth Farm Bill. So that means I've been in D.C. for over 20 years. If we don't have something out of the committees and across both chamber floors by May and conference, I just don't think we're going to be able to get it done this year. The presidential campaign started with Super Tuesday, and honestly, it started several months before that. But I mean, we are now in full presidential campaign mode, and it's going to be very difficult to get a farm bill through because those two issues is going to take all the air out of both chambers. And then whether it's because each party wants to make the other party take difficult votes or this or that. And to be honest, I don't know that we want to be caught up in presidential elections. So maybe even another year extension would be better for us. But the biggest concern with an additional extension is we continue to lose baseline, meaning we have less and less money every day to write a new farm bill.
Another area that wheat growers are concerned about, sustainable aviation fuel. Why?
I want to be very clear as I make this next statement. Of course, there's a lot of things we need to be looking for, but we continue to see a decline in wheat acreage in the United States. And I want to be clear that the National Association of Wheat Growers, we are very supportive of renewable fuels. We are very supportive of the renewable fuel standard, the RFS. But I think we would have our heads stuck in the sand if we didn't continue to raise just some of the economic concerns with the advanced aviation biofuels. And by that, what I'm really talking about is when you give a commodity like camelina a wider margin and larger profit earning capabilities because it is going to have a direct need with a new renewable fuel standard, so advanced aviation biofuels. And if you look where camelina is predominantly grown and planted, it literally fits right over a big chunk of our winter wheat belt here in the United States. And if you're a grower and you have a guaranteed margin that's going to generate revenue because it is going to a renewable fuels standard that has to be met, or plant wheat, which, you know, rises and falls with the market value, I am worried that we're going to be competing for acres against camelina, and I can see a significant issue with that as renewable fuels continue to take off, which are needed. We appreciate the clean energy, but I don't want to see it at the expense of the largest food grain industry in the United States.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yeah, there's several, but I'll hit on two or three that are top of the list for me.
Mark Isley is a Cheyenne, Wyoming cattle producer, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We've got to defend the beef checkoff. That informs our consumers, our producers, dietitians, medical personnel about the virtues and the value of beef. I think the other is the Farm Bill. That's conservation programs, indemnity, price protection, all those things that are multifaceted, working with agencies and making sure we can do our job well. And then I think, and this is of real importance to me, is the tax situation. The tax code, how it's written, and in particular the estate tax, the death tax. How many times does a family have to pay for a farm or a ranch over and over before it actually ever becomes theirs? That's a huge disincentive for young producers that want to come into the business and would love to take over and operate a family or multi-generational operation.
Those are priorities for the industry, and they get those from members. Ethan Lane, Vice President of Government Affairs.
The Cattle Industry Convention is our biggest meeting of the year. You know, we had about 7,000 people there in Orlando representing all, I think, 50 states were represented. Certainly all 44 of those state affiliate organizations were there with voting cards in hand and delegates to attend those policy committees. You know, this has been a hot topic for the last couple of years, and certainly all of those individual organizations have had time to talk about this at their county, respective county cattlemen's meetings and at their state meetings. And you know, coming into this process, knowing USDA is moving forward with rules, a lot of times, you know, that's what prompts a check-in on a policy position in the cattle industry. You know, the other time we get that opportunity is at our summer business meeting, and that happens every summer, and it's another round of those policy committees like the Cattle Health and Well-Being Committee that oversees this issue, sitting in and discussing these issues, hearing from government officials, hearing from industry, and making some decisions. So clearly, you know, at that convention in Orlando, I think we had affiliates that were looking to move this issue forward, for lack of a better description, to make this a more proactive position for the industry. We had other affiliates that were not ready with policy or not interested in moving that forward. And that's the debate that we are charged with facilitating at those meetings to make sure everybody's voice is heard and that discussion is fully had. So that we feel like we can leave that room with a common position. And you know, it's always one of those things interesting to watch, as the different states, talk to each other and kind of negotiate in the hallways. And what we came out of that with was, probably more, more of a unified position than we walked in with, although not a whole lot of change from where we were previously. There was a slight update to the policy that basically said that as an industry, we agree with the idea that that USDA is transitioning to these electronic ID tags for this class of cattle. There were others that would have liked to go further and say all cattle should be moving that direction. The body didn't feel that the industry was ready for that, and so that issue was not part of the finished product.
How do you know about the priorities?
You can always go to ncba.org, and when you do that, there's a policy tab. You can also get there by going to policy.ncba.org, and that'll show you all of our DC office information. It'll show you all the staff here in Washington. You can find the exact member of the staff you need to talk to based on the issue you're talking about. You can always reach out to me that way, and we can get you whatever information you need, or if you have an issue, something we need to be working on, we can get connected with you and get to work there. So a lot of information there to check out for producers across the country.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It happened when we did the judges. We begged Harry Reid not to do the judges, because he was doing the judges because he couldn't get Republicans that would give Obama his staff, put the staff together. And then Harry took it into the judges.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin recently at the Milken Institute's 2024 Global Conference on Politics talks about the mess short-term victories create.
And all Harry had to do, him and God rest his soul, he and Mitch McConnell did not communicate. They didn't seem to get along real well. And I told him, I said, Harry, all you have to do is go to Mitch and say, Mitch, these are will and pleasure. Do you understand the people that Obama wants will be gone when he's gone? They don't have any longer longevity. So let him have that decision. Let him, unless there's a criminal offense or something, let him have his staff. But they wouldn't communicate. So he says, we got to do the nuclear option. And when you go down that path, you can't reverse it.
That's right.
And if we go down at one path, if we had both, either one of us or both of us would have said, I don't think so. I said, maybe we need to fix this a little bit better. You can't. You just can't do that. And the only thing I have asked, anybody that comes to me and says, I want to run for the U.S. Senate, what do you think? I said, can I ask you one question? Would you defend the filibuster? I don't care if you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. If I don't get an answer that you're going to defend the filibuster, I'm not going to support you.
Manchin talks about the importance of the filibuster. That's echoed by Oklahoma Republican Senator James Linkford.
The filibuster is unique to the United States. If that blows up, we blow up bipartisan conversations. Yeah. That just goes away entirely.
Totally.
And the noise that we have right now gets even higher. And that doesn't help us as a country. The filibuster forces one place in government for people to talk to each other, and that's helpful.
Do we need to rethink, then, how we elect members to Congress? Alan Schwartz, Executive Chair, Guggenheim Partners.
I believe in open primaries. I believe in ranked choice. Part of it, besides giving people a chance, is also it changes the nature, the research I've seen on campaigning, i.e., voters say they don't like negative ads, but that's all they get. But if you're in an open primary, your ads can't be just about how bad somebody is. You have to prove you're better than
sure.
others. So it starts to make it more about how do you campaign in a way to tell people what you can deliver as opposed to keep out that evil one opponent.
Langford, not a big fan of ranked choice because of transparency issues, but there could be benefits to turning cameras off.
I represent my state. And my state needs to have the accountability to know where I stand and speak for it. What would change dramatically is to do more of our committee hearings and our markups with the cameras off.
No names. Absolutely.
The Armed Services Committee does that for their markups.
Oh, yeah.
Turn the cameras off. Let everybody fight through the
Absolutely.
Issues on that. Have a vote at the end of it, and it's actually done on it. That allows for frequent debate. Our committee hearings and our votes become right. like 15-second C-SPAN famous.
But outgoing Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, now an independent, says they need to check themselves.
Well, I would suggest that rather than doing that, we would want two things. One, political courage. Do the right thing that you know is right for your community and for your constituents. And number two, to have a constituency that supports those who do the right thing, even if they personally disagree with it on occasion.
Right.
Again, I don't think you can legislate a solution. This is a cultural change. People have to feel comfortable doing what they think is right, and they have to know that they will be supported and tolerated even if it is slightly different than what your base wants to see you do.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
USDA is projecting that the current U.S. winter wheat crop will come in 2% larger than last year.
If realized, this would be the first time in recent history, at least on this table, that we would have consecutive year-over-year increases.
Nick Streff with USDA's Statistics Service, which is forecasting a winter wheat crop of 1.28 billion bushels. Of course, for decades, the U.S. has seen wheat production decline almost every year. So are we on that leading edge of a new trend of more wheat production? USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says that would be nice.
But these 2 years of increase in a row are not on increases in area 2 years in a row. This year's increase in production relative to last year is on better conditions, improved yields, despite a fall in overall wheat area.
Which Meyer says in the long run will likely continue. Gary Crawford, Washington.